good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good to have you here. Thank you for joining us here. Kind of a last-minute thing, really. I'm Henrik with Red Ice TV. We have our co-host Reinhard with us today as well. And we have four upstanding gentlemen with us today that's going to join in. Seriously, though, we are going to discuss some of the legal issues that has unfolded since Charlottesville and give you guys out there a perspective that you won't get from the mainstream media when it comes to this, since they're hostile to this position. Very important you get an opportunity to hear these gentlemen and the battles that they're involved in. We're going to be involved in, too, legal measures that is sought after Charlottesville to probably prevent any similar kind of assembly from happening again anywhere in the United States. This might extend further, set precedents, etc. So our guests are Nathan Damigo, Richard Spencer, Eli Mosley, and James Edwards. Welcome, guys. Thank you for coming on. Say hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hey, what's up?
Good to have you guys here. So obviously I heard from Nathan and Eli and Richard through Reinhard here just a few days ago, really, about some of the lawsuits that were going on, and they proposed that we do something on it and bring attention to this. I know that there was going, but I didn't know the extent of it or what level this was at. So this is what I'm looking forward to diving into today, guys, and kind of finding out more about what it is that's happening and everything else. But before we do that, gentlemen, let's talk about what's happened in Texas and see what your guys' take on this is, because as usual, the longer we wait on these things without getting actually a description of the perpetrator, usually it's something that they are seeking to cover up or they're seeking to wait with it. Theories, gentlemen, initial thoughts, what are we looking at here, do you guys think?
I actually, Henrik, just received an email. We have a team that works with me. One is a former television news reporter in the New York area. And I actually just heard that the shooter seems to be a white Air Force veteran. Now, I haven't confirmed that, but that's what I'm hearing from a reliable source. So if that's the case, it's really hard to get an angle on it in the way that we would have at Antioch or even in Charleston.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very confused by some of these recent events. I really can't tell you what I think happened in Las Vegas, and that whole thing seems to be gone down the memory hole. We were actually just talking about it over dinner this evening, speculating on it. When you don't think about the perpetrator alleged, but you think about the victims, it's clear that these are white victims, and that shouldn't be forgotten or overlooked, and that might very well have something to do with the motive. The country music concert in Las Vegas, or this very small Baptist church that from what I could see by doing some cursory research was effectively an all-white church.
And
not just an all-white church, but obviously this is a small, rural, rooted community. They're kind of the ultimate boogeyman, you could say, for a lot of liberals. So that might have absolutely nothing to do with what happened. That's just where we are right now, and I think it probably had at least something to do with the motivation.
Yeah, I was thinking about November 4th, guys. Right, November 4th was a massive failure. Some have speculated we would see stuff like this in the wake of it. I mean, who knows, right? But it's interesting. Eli, go ahead.
Well, the other thing too is this is actually 8 years to the day of the Nadal Hassan shooting, Fort Hood, Texas shooting. So, I mean, I don't think that we should really rule out everything quite yet. The fact that they were Air Force as well is a little interesting. We just don't know what it is. But like Richard said, what we do know is that the victims obviously were disproportionately white, and that's kind of how we should see it. But the other thing, too, is this is just showing, like, a constant breakdown in societal norms. The status quo is just not going to hold up to this. You know, one of these mass shootings happening every month is not going to last very long without people really begging for change in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Guys, are there theories about what we're looking at? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I saw something on Twitter saying that the shooter, whose name, let me find his name real quick. Well, actually, I think it's still speculative, so maybe I won't throw it out there. But the shooter is presumed to have been an atheist. Some people have been digging through this guy's social media already and so forth. So, I mean, I think there's the potential for there being a left-wing motivation here is much more likely than there being a right-wing motivation. I've already seen people accuse him of being, like, you know, radical right-wing, radical Christian terrorist. radical right-wing or Christian terrorists don't generally shoot up churches, so, or at least white churches.
It's just so early into this. I mean, you're only a couple of hours into it. Some people are just crazy, and it's just as simple as that. There doesn't necessarily have to be a racial or political angle involved, although normally there is in a situation like this. But if he was, in fact, a former, if he was, in fact, white, and all of this fleshes out, it is hard to get a real motivation or at least a real clue at it. But I would doubt if he was former Air Force, he's going to be Antifa or anything like that unless he had some great awakening later in life. But it'll be interesting to see. But either way, the victims are who we know them to be, and that's a tragedy for sure.
Yeah, there was a couple of earlier shootings at other churches, right, which were racially motivated. There was not the coverage on par with Charleston. So that, you know, we'll just have to wait and see how this pans out. But again, as usual, they're usually very quickly with naming and kind of, you know, it's a white man behind it. If that's the case, in other cases, they just withhold that altogether. So we'll just have to see.
Yeah, I for one will say that I'm very surprised that it wasn't a boomer who, did this particular of terrorism. I think boomer, radical boomer terrorism is the main threat, even if it wasn't the issue in this particular incident.
All right. Okay, interesting. So a lot of stuff happening, and exactly as you said, Richard, I mean, since Las Vegas, I mean, it's just to get a – I mean, it could be
an
issue.
Remember, when I was growing up, we – and I was born in 1978. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, effectively. We were talking about Columbine for at least a month, really months after that. I mean, that was a national wound – that had to be discussed ad infinitum. It is amazing the degree to which things just move so quickly and these matters just get memory hold. The Las Vegas shooting, as horrific as it was, and as just ambiguous and bizarre as the whole story was, has effectively been memory hold.
That's right.
You know, the liberals tried to use it for a gun control push, you know, as usual. There was a lot of heavy theorizing going on, but that is over, and we seem to just keep moving on. I don't know if it's it's probably a combination of a short attention span, of just social media, the news cycle being accelerated.
Could we assume, guys, that if there isn't any clear motive given by the authorities, that it is kind of an attempted cover-up to make sure that the wrong information doesn't leak out?
If his motivation fit the narrative, they would have probably had that out there before the gun barrel cooled.
That's true.
Sure.
That's true. All right. Well, interesting.
But for a gun control narrative, it might be. And again, no one should take this as implying anything more than it is. But if the overarching narrative is about gun control, then attacks on white people would arguably be more effective in presenting that message, because it is effectively the Republican voting base, Trump's base, that and their representatives that is preventing gun control by being enacted. I mean, there are huge constituencies for gun control right now. The liberals have been yammering about this since I've been alive. You know, without that white bloc that does not want any further gun legislation, we would have had serious restrictions on gun rights by now.
Mm, yeah, it's true.
They'll certainly fall back on that default position. If they can't find anything else that they can mine out of this incident, they'll go back to the gun control narrative, of course. We've already seen that a little bit today. You'll see more of it in the coming days for sure.
Yeah, well, that's also very much a distraction as well, to keep people's attention away from the fact that with what little we do know about the Vegas shooter, he was a registered Democrat. He was at one of these pussy hat rallies that was thrown after the inauguration in resistance to Trump. And so they will want to distract. And it's if you just look at basic profiling, if the shooter was white, as we've talked about earlier, there's a good chance he could be and likely would have you know, contemporary left wing or cultural Marxist views. If he had a motive that was something other than serious psychological illness,
We should hold the media accountable, I think, much more than we do, considering the hatred that they're ramping up towards Trump and his supporters.
That's what they missed in the Alexandria shooting. the Republicans should have immediately jumped on that to put forward legislation and policies and start talking about how the media had created that shooter and how the media created this issue. Like, the Democrats and the left wing always do this. They always politicize issues. They always take advantage of crisis. And the right wing has never done this. And as soon as that shooting happened in Alexandria, how long ago was that now? Just a couple months ago now, right?
Yeah.
About 2 years ago.
The media should have been the focal point of the right-wing establishment's attack, which just shows that they just have no interest in actually winning or passing any type of legislation. They should have passed, you know, controls on the media at most, but at the very, very least, they should have put forward legislation for national reciprocal concealed carry and things like that. But they did nothing effectively with literally their own congressperson being shot.
Very good. Okay, well, gentlemen, let's move on here and talk a bit about Charlottesville and switch gears a little bit. And just give us an update, guys. I read a few articles here, and obviously there are some names that were named. Some of you were implied in them directly. There are different talks about different groups, what's sought to be done, etc. Just give the viewers, guys, if you can, an overview of what has happened after Charlottesville. If you guys have been... Have you been served? Are they trying to go after you in different ways? Just give us a rundown, guys, on what's happened.
So immediately after Charlottesville, there was a tweet that went out saying that there was going to be a number of people who would be served in a lawsuit complaining that we had essentially sought to violate people's rights and go there and commit violence. We weren't sure at first whether or not that was going to be something that would be upheld by the local courts. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how that stuff works. I thought it was something that would just get thrown out and dismissed as a frivolous lawsuit or something like that. And several weeks ago, we were actually having a yard sale, and an individual came up onto our property. I thought it was just someone who was going to look at some of the stuff we had, and he actually came up and served me this big stack of sheets, and I knew exactly what it was as soon as he handed it to me. And I think that it's also not the only one out there. I've heard that there's actually other, maybe one or two others that are floating around. But we basically went ahead. This was about 2 weeks ago. The Western District of Virginia, where this has been filed, essentially, once you've been served, you have about 21 days to respond. So we have till, I think about Friday, or I particularly have till about Friday. I was also served for, Identity Europa as well. There's just a huge long list. It's basically a who's who of the alt-right almost, for anyone who had anything at all to do with, that event, even if it was just going or something like that. They've thrown everybody on this thing as far as co-defendants. So what we've been trying to do is we've been trying to get the funds together to go ahead and get into court and just reply right away, because they can actually receive a default judgment if we don't respond on time. So what we're trying to do right now is locate a good, solid attorney that we can just get in there and respond, and then that will kind of get us some time. But essentially what they are trying to say and convict us with is essentially they're trying to say that a couple things. One, they're trying to say that we went there with the intent to harm people, and that we went there with the intent to violate people's civil rights and intimidate them. Now, the statute that they're pointing to, I've talked to some lawyers over the last couple weeks, and it sounds like the statute they're pointing to, first off, doesn't have anything to do with anything they're alleging. It's almost something entirely separate. It has something to do with back in the Klan days with voter intimidation or something like that. That's what the lawyers who have looked at it can the only thing they've been able to figure out. So it would be a bit of a stretch, and it's a strange thing that they're using that. But they're out of this 96 pages of evidence that we allegedly went there to intimidate people or to violate their rights or whatever, or to harm them. There really isn't like a single word or sentence that actually shows anything, that substantiates anything that they're saying in this lawsuit. So We are very confident that the judge will see this for what it is and dismiss it. However, I can't emphasize enough to everyone that's watching how important this is. And sometimes the way things should go and should work according to law don't always happen, and the real world happens, and you've got these, you may have a judge who deep down inside harbors ill will towards us and goes ahead and allows the case to go forward instead of throwing it out. And then, you know, you may have a jury of six people or so, however many they'll have in this case, who really just, one, don't understand law enough to understand that this case doesn't really hold up, or, you know, are blinded by, ideologically blinded, and they just hear, you know, the prosecutor or whoever saying, you know, KKK, white supremacist over and over again, and they get scared and they're like, oh, these must be bad people or something like that. And there is a potential, to lose this. So we have to take this very seriously. We have to get the best lawyers we can possibly get, and that's not going to be cheap. We've been doing a fundraiser for the last couple days now, and we've raised quite a bit, but we still have a very long way to go till we meet our goal. And even if this thing is dismissed right off the bat, we've got a lot of money still there. The reality is that this lawfare is going to be something that's going to be continually waged against us. It is, in its own right, a form of activism. And the lawyers on this case are activist lawyers who are looking to eat up our time, eat up our resources, try to get in our heads and stress us out. They're trying to do everything they can to slow us down. So, this is something that needs to get taken very seriously, and anyone who can help out with this, they can go to our website. You'll find a list of ways to donate. You can go to our Patreon account to the Identity Europa Defense Fund, and you can donate there, or you can donate through PO Box, which is also on our website. There's several other ways. Bitcoin, we've got that as well. So that is kind of the gist of what's going on right now as far as that's concerned.
Gentlemen, let's add some more to that. Richard, Eli?
Well, I feel like we might be able to conclude the podcast.
Well, there's a lot of motives we can talk about here, but is there anything in addition to what Nathan just mentioned there to summarize the thing that we should add?
No, I would direct people to check out the Foundation for the Free Market of Ideas. That is effectively the vehicle we're using, and that is a 501c3 as well, so you can make a tax-deductible contribution. I 100% trust Kyle Bristow. He has been very helpful in terms of legal matters with me. I mean, I could not have done what I have done in terms of these college tours, et cetera, without Kyle. So I think everyone should have the utmost confidence. And I do think that we do need to build up a war chest, because this is not the first, and it is certainly not the last, of frivolous lawsuits that are going to occur. And we were able to rely on the ACLU. I mean, we forget the whole story of Charlottesville, but the ACLU actually backed Jason Kessler for a time in terms of getting a permit for us to appear in Lee or Emancipation Park. What I have heard is that the ACLU had a huge surge in donations after Trump, when, you know, liberals wanted to get that good feeling in their tummy by writing a $100 check to the ACLU. You're battling against the forces of oppression and all so on. And so a lot of their new donors in particular were pushing back against the ACLU, and they don't want them to support everyone's civil rights. And so that's something we simply, I don't think we can rely on those groups. If we can utilize them in some fashion, that's fine. But we simply can't rely on them. There's no cavalry coming over the ridge. It's up to us.
Yeah, indeed. So what are, I mean, you mentioned it, Nathan, a little bit already there, but let's talk about some of the motivations, obviously, behind this, that it's both, I believe, to set a precedent, but also to basically occupy people, make sure to shut down any level of organization, and also make sure that this level of event is not going to be able to be held in the future, right? That's really what it is. Right after the event itself, there was an issue, of course, of the police stopping the freedom of assembly issue and all that. That there was, you know, counter lawsuits filed against that. But ultimately, I think it's just to shut this thing down, and they're seeking to do it through legal means.
Exactly. Remember this, the MPI conference that will still be taking place, but it'll be taking place privately, was to take place at the Ronald Reagan Building, which is a federal facility. It's the largest federal facility for events in Washington, D.C., and it's actually the largest building in terms of size in the District of Columbia. They have been shutting us down. I think there was a concerted effort coming from many different sources to stop alt-right events from occurring, to really stop us in our tracks. This lawsuit is not just about, you know, supposed civil rights crimes. It is about stopping any kind of expression of white identity in a public way from ever occurring again.
In a legal way. Which is very. I mean, what could? Let's talk about potential scenarios here, gentlemen. Of what could happen? I mean, could you guys? I mean, there was millions involved here in terms of you know, going after people and organizations and everything else. And I don't know. Again, if this is divided up among an individual here, an organization there, etc., multiple parties like that, it seems to have been served, right? But this could effectively, could it put people in jail? I guess that's the essential question to ask.
No. From my understanding, no one could serve time for this, but the damages were set at $3 million.
Right.
So that's a hefty chunk of change.
And if you can't pay that, can't they put you in jail then?
Yeah, I think the most likely situation is that, or this is the one we're all hoping for, is that it's just going to get dismissed. We might have to spend some money, you know, just doing the basic kind of legal duties, getting a lawyer to do them rather, in order to get it dismissed. So that's kind of the one that we're hoping for. But then there's the potential for it not to get dismissed and for the case to just to continue on. And that's going to be very costly, very time-consuming. That is, I think, what they're going for. They know that even if they don't win, they don't get all of our money, essentially, that they are going to put a massive... they're really going to stymie the progress of the alt-right in the upcoming months, if not longer. And then obviously we could win after we go through all of that, so it'll be very expensive and time-consuming. Or the worst-case scenario is that we lose. I'm pretty confident that we're not going to lose this, but again, this is kind of, we do need all of the support that we can get. It's going to be pretty expensive, and it's going to, it's really going to... Just like I said, stymie the growth of all of the, you know, organizations that are represented in here. It's going to prevent us from, you know, putting out more content, doing more activism, and so forth.
Yeah. One thing I think about this whole thing that it really sets up 2018 for us in a way. So 2016 we had Trump, we had the online stuff, and then 2017 can really be summed up that it was an activism year where we went out and did many, many events. I mean, we did dozens of events all over the country. And 2018 is going to be the year, I think, that we're going to end up needing to build institutions. We're going to need to build legal teams. We're going to need to build kind of our own parallel services. I mean, with the way the Internet's been treated, you know, with Daily Storm and things like that and their censorship, this is obviously an issue with the Internet. You know, with Kyle now being able to step forward for the legal issue, that's obviously something we need to build out. So I think 2018 is going to be kind of the year that we all start building around real things. And if there is a silver lining to this, it's that, you know, a lot of us, I know, are sitting around maybe in 2015 or 2016 saying, oh, yeah, we should have a white ADL or we should have a white ACLU or things like that. And, you know, those are just ideas. But really they've pushed us into a corner where we actually literally need that. And it's been forming. I mean, it's forming out of a reaction to this, which if you look back at the history of a lot of these organizations, they formed out of it. And they formed in a lot of similar ways where there was a specific instance that forced them to organize, collectivize, and get serious. So, I mean, I think that this being such a frivolous, ridiculous lawsuit is a good thing in the fact that it's showing, it's getting us together. And just like they dox us and they think that makes us go away and retreat and recoil and things like that, you know, they think they're going to sue us. And in fact, we're going to come out of this as a stronger, more organized, and more serious movement. And all that this takes is that we do have the grassroots support that, I mean, we've shown since the last, I guess, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, I really don't think these activist lawyers understand that. In a large way, they're actually really helping us, because every time we've met a challenge like this, and there's been a sense of urgency, people have stepped up and stepped up to the plate, whereas otherwise they may have just kind of remained in the shadows and off on the sidelines. So I really don't think they realize, first off, what type of favor they're doing for us. We've got all sorts of lawyers now jumping out of the woodworks, and now we're creating this kind of vast army of lawyers. Now, the issue we're having is that we don't seem to have a lawyer in the Western District of Virginia right now. However, there are lawyers popping up all over the place that we will be able to utilize in future cases.
Guys, let's just remind people, too. I should have done that earlier, but let's just remind people again what actually triggered the violence and what's at the root of this. For newcomers that might be tuning into this because they're interested in the case and whatnot, there was an F1.0 event that was successful. The 2.0 was a disaster. The 3.0 was kind of a flash mob scenario where you guys also showed up. Some of you showed up to show that it basically could be done. We would, get in, get out, just do what we want to do, and that's it. What happened during 2.0 that specifically caused it to turn into this direction?
Well, you want to go?
Sure. I mean, I'll just talk about my personal experience at 2.0. Yes, 1.0 occurred in May. And it was partially organized by Eli. I certainly had a hand in it. Yes, and we did catch them by surprise in the sense that Charlottesville and really the world had not seen alt-right activism on the scale yet. And Nathan Damigo was there, many others, and it was a wild success. We got the Tiki Torch rally meme going at that point. I agree that Charlottesville, too, was a catastrophe, and to a certain degree. I do think it was ultimately a net positive in the sense that we had to go through an event like this. We had to be cracked down upon the government. But anyway, I think Charlottesville 3 was a huge net positive because under the tremendous amount of pressure, we demonstrated our resolve and our moxie in order to do a flash mob, and that, on a tiny budget made, headlines around the world. Anyway, Charlottesville 2, my experience of it was that we went to the field. I was maced going in to Lee or Emancipation Park, as were others. That was a very common experience among alt-right activists, also among journalists and many others. The state police were basically playing games with us. We never at any moment got a chance to speak. And then out of the blue, it wasn't quite out of the blue, it was at a very set time, it was at noon, the police came out, they were in militarized uniforms, they had riot shields, they had been preparing for this for hours, if not days. They came out and they announced that according to the Commonwealth, the state of emergency has been declared. You must, cease and desist, leave this park. So before a single person took the stage, before any kind of major violence took place, there were some scuffles, I got maced, but there was effectively no major violence. Before any of that took place, the police cleared Emancipation Park. And what they did is they forced all of the peaceful protesters and activists and speakers out of the park onto Market Street, which is this major street running through Charlottesville, which is where the Antifa lay in wait. And then after they did this, I think one might assume, I do, that there was some kind of stand down order because effectively a melee took place. And so from my standpoint, not only did Charlottesville suppress free speech, which they did, no one spoke at that rally. There was interesting, CBS News drama that did a kind of parody of Charlottesville 2, and I guess part of the parody was that we actually got to speak Charlottesville. Anyway, we did in real life, no one got a chance to say anything, and we were forced into the Antifa on Market Street. A total melee occurred, so the police did not just fail to do their job, they did the opposite of their job. They created anarchy. They ultimately bear responsibility for the injuries and death that occurred on that day. And it was an absolute outrage in terms of the suppression of our rights. Now, might we in the future want to levy some kind of suit against the city of Charlottesville? That's going to be very difficult, but I think it is something that we should certainly consider. A much bigger, more well-funded movement, you can imagine that, you know, they would already have launched such a suit. You know, so outrageous was the behavior of the city of Charlottesville, the Charlottesville police, and the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Here is one.
That's
Richard.
What happened in Charlottesville, too. And I think that narrative is creeping out. The initial narrative was, these are terrorists. We need to investigate the alt-right for being literally ISIS. That was the day one narrative. That has actually dissipated quite a bit. And there was a lot more skepticism about the handling of the Charlottesville situation coming even from liberals and leftists.
Yeah, here's a lawsuit where one of the guys on the other side, if I can put it that way, basically also decides to sue the police because they enabled him to get hurt. So although it's, you know, from the wrong reasons, it's a good that they're going after the cops even on that side, because they are ultimately the ones to blame, as you say, for this. And then on top of it, we have, and it has to be emphasized over and over again, the media, they're basically lying and constructing. And thank God that Trump at least had the balls to say that there was, like, an opposite side in this battle, if you will, that took place in Charlottesville. No one else mentioned it. And he, of course, incredibly lambasted for daring to propose that there was violence on the opposite side here, which is remarkable. But thank God that he did it, right?
Well, something else about this this lawsuit, actually, and what they're claiming and what's kind of strange about it is that some of the individuals who have tacked on to this lawsuit and are claiming that we went there with the intent to violate people's civil rights, to intimidate them, and to use violence, they themselves were part of that same Antifa mob who, when I went to court just several weeks ago to try to get the charges overturned against myself, and there were several other people as well who had refused to leave the park because the order was definitely unlawful and a violation of our court injunction that we had. We actually had the police in court admit that the people out on Market Street did not have a permit to be there, and they were unlawfully assembled, and that a lot of the violence was being done by them. And this also, so it's kind of strange that they're trying to sue us for the exact thing that they were doing themselves. They showed up to shut down our event. There's plenty of proof of this all over the internet, on their websites. Many of the more public Antifa individuals said they went there with the intent to do that. And I also don't think they've thought this through yet, because they have so much of the media on their side, they've really bought into kind of their own bullshit. And I don't think they realize that if this makes it into court, this can turn on them very, very fast. Because what they're claiming we went there to do, there's more than enough proof to show that they themselves actually did that, and more. And furthermore, we had actually... We were not the organizers of Seaville 2, and however, because we were a large organization, we had the local law enforcement reach out to us. We wanted to make sure that, you know, okay, we were going to come down this street and everything would be safe and whatnot. And we tried to work with them as far as, you know, routes going in and out were concerned. And they actually gave us assurances that they were going to keep Market Street clear of counter demonstrators. And they simply did not. They were playing games with us, and this certainly was, in my estimation, a complete setup. And I actually would go as far as to say I have a really hard time believing that there wasn't complete intent in what they did by allowing the counter demonstrators to be there in the streets as we were trying to get into the park, and to use that as their reason for calling off the demonstration.
Yeah.
And I think a lot more of this is definitely going to come to light moving forward.
Well, this is the thing, guys. I mean, to a certain extent, it's good to get this kind of hashed out in a court of law, obviously, but we cannot expect that there's going to be fair trials or anything like that here. I mean, there's been foul play already involved in this. I don't know if it's intelligence services or if it's just the local police or if it's somehow the mayor and these other people in Charlottesville. But surely we cannot be as naive to expect that they wouldn't try to just do a botched trial here and just make sure that they shut this kind of organization and activism down, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would follow you all the way towards this is going to be an entirely unfair trial and that it's going to be a kangaroo court and we'll all be, marched out of the courtroom into center square and hanged. I don't think that's going to happen. I do think in the fairly unlikely case that this case does go to trial, I think we will win handedly. I don't think that the judicial system is. I don't want to say it's on the side of the little man or that justice is blind or anything like that. But this case is very outrageous and would set all sorts of really terrible precedents. I don't think it has long for this world, to be honest.
Well, what they're suggesting is that we went there to basically stop them from having their civil rights, when it was literally the opposite. So the left is up to their typical tricks, where they're basically saying, you guys were the ones who went there to stop civil rights while we blocked the street on Market Street. It's absolutely absurd. The leftist cries out as they strike you or whatever, where they're basically saying, they're accusing us of what they did themselves, like Nathan originally had said. So I don't think that we have too much to worry about, although I would say that we have seen a trend with the age of Trump, with activist judges kind of going rogue and sure. legislating from the bench in a way that we haven't really seen for a little bit. So I'm a little worried with that kind of thing. And then the big deal here that people need to realize is that I don't think collectively everyone in the court case right now has, $3 million just laying around. And this could really hurt, basically what we've been doing. We have been raising the consciousness of our people over the last year. And even if it were to be settled, like, for half that amount, it would be a huge setback. It would be a huge setback, in a time during Trump where we basically have 3 more years to push the envelope, continue to waken our people up, continue to red pill our people, and this would be a huge opportunity cost to our movement.
Yeah, good point. Guys, will James Fields get a fair trial?
I do hope so. James Fields is in a very difficult situation because, first off, there's the obvious, which is scapegoating and people wanting some kind of blood guilt price to be paid, and this man is going to pay it. Another man who seems to be paying this price is Christopher Cantwell, who certainly made some mistakes, but none of his mistakes are even close to deserving the treatment he has received by the Virginia government. And the fact that he is not out on bail, and yet a man using an improvised blowtorch is out on bail. I don't know if you've seen those images and read about that story.
Yeah.
It's an absolute outrage. Free Cantwell, 100%. Cantwell is a political prisoner. The Fields case is a more ambiguous because while I think we can imagine Cantwell is going to respond to this matter, we don't know what's going to happen with James Fields. There is no one knew James Fields, at least anyone that I've talked to. I don't know how he is going to react to this, major peril that he's in. The problem with him is that he was declared guilty. It was declared a premeditated murderous terrorist act by none other than the chief of police of the city of Charlottesville on that day. And actually, this man, for whom I have no respect, by the way, claimed that because of James Fields, that was the reason that a state of emergency had to be declared. Apparently, this man has a time machine, or else he is a complete moron. It's either one of the two, or he's lying, one of the three. Because the fact is, the state of emergency was declared long before, hours before, the incident which took place with James Field, which itself was highly ambiguous. I mean, the fact is he ran that his Dodge Challenger rammed into another car, which caused a very serious injuries, which are terrible, and might have caused the death of Heather Heyer, who apparently has died of a heart attack and not a ramming injury. This might very well be considered murder. This might very well be considered manslaughter. James Fields might very well be innocent. And the fact is, when you are declared guilty by the chief of police, this just obviously stupid token that they have up there, it is very difficult to get a truly fair trial. And he is on trial for his life.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot more serious than what we're facing. Now, I don't want to, again, I feel like I'm almost being the reasonable guy in the room. I don't want to harm fundraising by claiming that I actually am confident of about our case. We definitely need a legal war chest led by Bristow and Company, that will be our legal defense for this and going forward. We absolutely need to fundraise for that. We are in a serious thing, but James Fields, I don't know how he's going to react. I don't know how he's going to plead. I don't know what strategy his lawyer is going to pursue. But he's on trial literally for his life.
And there's no, as far as I know, there's no like reaching these guys. There's no talking. There's another example of this. And again, the reason why I bring this up, why I think it's important, is because I just don't trust law enforcement in this case and what they're doing. The case when you were speaking in Florida, Richard, with the two Fears brothers, for example, I was reading right. The police report. It was so bizarre. And the fact is, we don't know what happened. The police report said that there was, the victim said that they were being shot at and stuff like that. It could literally have been a similar scenario where they were being cornered and the only way for them to defend themselves was to fire a shot, whether that was in the air or above their heads or something. We just don't know. That's my point.
And the other part of that story was that their car was attacked before.
Exactly.
They did anything. Now, I don't want to pass any kind of judgment. My attitude towards this is what should have been the attitude of the Charlottesville chief of police. I think there should be a fair investigation. If they did anything wrong, or if they use wildly disproportionate force in defense, i.e., if someone pushes you and you shoot them, that is not appropriate, to say the least, and certainly not legal. If they use wildly disproportionate force,
of course, the only thing I
certainly want them to be punished. But the fact is, at this point, I just want them to have a fair investigation, a fair trial.
Again, bail for them were set in.
City of Charlottesville had to say
bail for them was set at $3 million. I mean, no one can even speak with these guys. No one can get to them and ask them what happened. Did this happen? The only thing you read in the police report is, the victim states they're being shot at. How do we know that was not on the political opposition and they were just making up the story? We just don't know when we don't have any proof for it. That's what worries me about these cases.
Right.
That cops can just literally just go after people randomly, whoever they point at or something. I don't know. We don't know. That's my point.
Yeah,
if I recall correctly, there was quite a bit of time that elapsed between when this incident took place and when they reported it to the police. I could be wrong about that, but I seem to remember there being like hours and hours in between, meaning like that they gave them plenty of time to just kind of concoct, the most politically useful narrative they could on that particular incident.
Yeah, I mean, who were they up against? Look at the article here. Well, three men were making Nazi salutes and repeated Hitler chants. So it's like, oh, really? And that's the victim saying that? I mean, we have no way of knowing. Yeah, we have no way of knowing, and they could just literally.
Well, one thing for me, and this is something that we have to go forward in planning, is both of these incidences happened with people who were not involved directly in the planning, as well as it happened well after the event. And I think that whenever we're communicating with police and whenever we're kind of planning these events, and like not just public rallies, but Richard's college tour, even flash mobs to some extent, we need to be better at planning exit strategies, and not just for the people directly involved, but for everyone else involved, making sure the police understand that. James Fields, I think that incident happened 2 hours after I was already out of Lee Park.
Yeah.
And the Gainesville incident happened well after that. I think the reporting, like you were saying, Reinhardt, the report didn't come in until like 5 hours after Gainesville or something like that.
Exactly.
So I just think it's like, kind of moving forward when we plan these things. Now we have to kind of realize that realistically, like you had said, Heinrich, we need to be careful that they're going to try to basically give us kangaroo courts and screw us over. It'd be better to actually have these types of things in our control, in our hands, just from the get-go when we plan these sorts of things.
Just imagine how easy it is, though, for the cops to concoct these kinds of stories. Again, I'm not implying that nothing happened with the Fierce brothers and this other guy, Tyler Tenbrink, but regardless, it can literally just be a case of guilt by association. So whenever there is a speech, whenever there is a event or something, oh, see, there's always violence and shooting and, you know, things associated with it, and we just don't know if that's the truth or not, and this might be concocted so that they can basically crack down on us and make sure that we can't continue any activism. So I think people should be aware of that, and I don't even know if there's any strategy to stopping that. I mean, you cannot stop individuals from showing up, right? I mean, it's impossible.
Oh, exactly. These are major public events at this point. And the idea that we can be held accountable for every single person who might want to come, you know, and every single motive that they might have is just absolutely absurd.
Yep, could be sting operations for all we know. So it's very, very strange. And I think people need to be aware of it. And I don't know if that's a worrying element moving forward as well, that we should be careful about this. We should be careful about associations or who shows up or says what or whatever. And I think that it's the case with Charlottesville 2.0 as well. I mean, there was literally the people showing up. And I think we should talk about this for a little bit with the flags, right? And getting their photo shoots, and they're showing up in their hoodies and their clown outfits and stuff. And basically, perfectly managed to twist the media story and get the shots that they want, basically. And now the association is there forever, and it's unfortunately very unfortunate because now you know the association is there. So, but what I'm saying is, I don't know if any of you have suggestions or proposals on this, but is there any way to control that better, to basically make sure that we have the people that we know that shows up? Any thoughts?
Well, we did control that absolutely with Charlottesville 3.0. Which we did I guess it was a little over a month ago, and that was a flash mob. It was about 15 minutes in length. We got our message across. We got in and out, and that was actually a really tightly organized, you know, military-like operation. And we can do flash mobs. A little bit before then, we actually did the day of Charlottesville, we were at the Jefferson Memorial. It was an unannounced flash mob. I think 2 weeks before that, we actually did an event where we protested DACA and Trump's seeming support for that, although we'll wait and see, of course. We did that outside of the White House. That was also a flash mob. That went very well. So I do think that is one way forward. That should probably be the primary way forward at this point. That being said, look, we are citizens of this country. I mean, I pay taxes. I've got a driver's license. I have a passport too. Last time I checked, I have my birth certificate, which reads Kenya. But no, just kidding. My birth certificate reads Boston, Massachusetts. I was born in this country. We have the right to assemble publicly. That doesn't mean that we should do it without a great deal of forethought or just do it in a shoot from the hip fashion. But the fact is, we are citizens, we have a point of view, we have the right to express that point of view in a public fashion, and we need to do that eventually. Flash mobs are great, but again, we need to take part in the public discussion, and one huge way of doing that is through public rallies.
James, let's have you join into the conversation here a little bit as well. I know that you've been fighting another type of legal a lawsuit, basically, here against defamation, and you can remind the audience what media outlets that this was concerning, but this is another kind of faction to the same bigger problem, really, that we're talking about. What happened for you, James, in your case?
Thank you, Henrik. I've been a silent partner thus far in the interview today because I didn't have the firsthand involvement and firsthand perspective that our friends had in Charlottesville. But I wasn't brought on to talk about Charlottesville. I was brought on to talk about the case that received a decision in the Michigan Court of Appeals on Wednesday. So if people are unfamiliar with that case, I'll take you back, just give you a brief history. We all remember the wild experience that 2016 was. And it was particularly wild for me. In 2016, I received press credentials from the Trump campaign to cover a rally for my radio program. I was also given permission to broadcast that show live from the press pen while Trump was speaking
at that event. 2 days later, I interviewed Donald Trump Jr. There was a big media feeding frenzy over that, and it really the year. I was later credentialed to attend the Republican National Convention. Even later than that, was at the inauguration. Was actually front row at the inauguration, about 20 feet from the president when he was sworn in. But as far as my court case is concerned, it goes back to March of 2016 when everybody was really piling on about the fact that I'd been credentialed and given access to Donald Trump Jr. One of the newspapers, this being the Detroit News, that is the daily newspaper that services the city of Detroit, they wrote an article specifically Trump, and the focus of that article were people that were supporting Donald Trump. And they listed me in that article as a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, of course, we all suffer the indignity of being called racist and white supremacist, but from a legal standpoint, cannot sue someone for that because it constitutes rhetorical hyperbole. It is their opinion. Of course, the definition of racist and even white supremacist is very fluid. Those words can mean different things to different people, and you can't bring a lawsuit for someone calling you a racist. If that was the case, everybody would be slinging lawsuits left and right. Donald Trump's been called a racist, obviously, even Mitt Romney, John McCain. If you're white, you're a racist if you're involved in politics. We know that. But, which is basically the Bible for law, states that the textbook definition of what constitutes defamation is, in fact, alleging someone to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan. That is the quintessential illustration of what constitutes defamation. And so I took it under advisement with about six well-respected attorneys. Kyle Bristow has represented me throughout this 18-month experience. And we thought that, number one, we had a firm which to launch this lawsuit, but more importantly than that, I thought that it was, in fact, very damaging personally. It does take it to the next level to have someone allege you to be a member of the Klan or a member of ISIS or a member of Al-Qaeda or a member of a terrorist organization. So we lost on the lower court level, on the trial level, in 2016. We appealed it to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and we received our decision from the Michigan Court of Appeals on Halloween morning, Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. This was a published decision, which is quite rare, which means it will be cited going forward. It will be a precedent-setting decision. And we had a panel of three judges who ruled unanimously in favor of the defendants, a little bit different than in some of the situation with Charlottesville. I was the plaintiff in this particular court case, and I filed suit against the Detroit newspaper and the columnist who wrote that article. If you read the 11-page decision, which has made the rounds on Twitter, National Public Radio covered it earlier this week and some other news outlets. It wasn't a national news story, but it did receive some play. I'll read you just the first couple of sentences. If you read the first couple of sentences, you would have thought that justice was served and I won the case. This is what the panel of judges wrote. The restatement of torts lists, quote, membership in the Ku Klux Klan, end quote, as the quintessential illustration of a defamatory statement. In an opinion piece in the Detroit News, columnist Van Cole Thompson asserted that radio show host James Edwards is a leader of the Ku Klux Klan. There is no record evidence to suggest that Edwards holds a former leadership position in the Ku Klux Klan, nor is there any evidence to suggest that he is even a member. That's when it goes south. They say essentially, right, notwithstanding that, they are instructed by Aesop's fables to judge a man he keeps. And because I have longstanding friendships with, namely, Sam Dixon and David Duke, who were specifically mentioned in this opinion, therefore, essentially, the law doesn't apply to me. They also said, leader doesn't mean what you think it means, that my definition of leader, which means one that is actively involved in an organization and is its figurehead, is just a very narrow interpretation of the word leader. It could mean that members of the Klan, if they listen, they might agree with some of the things I've said, so therefore I could be constituted as an opinion leader. They also quarreled over what the word it means, and this is all in this 11-page decision.
It was like Bill Clinton's trial, remember? What we need to define what is, right? Yeah. Ridiculous, obviously.
So basically, I don't think that's something. Look, we are positioning ourselves as serious, thoughtful people capable of not only just leading organizations, but perhaps leading a nation with the people that you have assembled here today. This really constitutes some of our best and brightest. And I can tell you that none of us enjoy the labels that are affixed to us, but you sure don't want to be to have your name presented in the press as the leader of the Ku Klux Klan. So we lost on the Court of Appeals. Though there's been a lot said about that decision. I think, though, when you have, again, and I can't stress this enough, when you have the restatement of torts saying this is exactly what constitutes defamation, this is exactly what they, but the law doesn't apply to me because of this guilt by association. You were just mentioning that a few minutes ago. Then that's a disturbing precedent to be sure. And then we also saw this week, of course, with the cancellation of NPI from a federal building. That's two pretty interesting setbacks, I guess you could say, that I really think flies in the face of existed for decades in these fields. And again, like Richard said, the Kyle Bristow's organization, I don't think anyone could have argued my case in court any better than Kyle. He's really brilliant. He's a genius. If we're going to win battles going forward, it will be people like Kyle that that shows us how to do it. But this, I think it strongly argues against the sentiment that we can, in fact, get a fair trial. Now, I thought certainly I might lose the case because of my political opinions. I thought that they might say, well, yes, this is, well, they did in fact say this. This is textbook defamation, but since James Edwards is a public figure, the bar is a little bit higher to prove injury or damages. I thought they might say something like that, even though I would have disagreed with that opinion. I thought they might have said something like that, but what I didn't think they would say was that, yes, he's 100% right, but he is beyond the law in this capacity. So if this is what we can expect going forward from the courts, and I know there have been some people who say them, but because the makeup of the panel were two Jewish judges and a black woman, that I wasn't going to receive a fair trial. I'm not saying I agree with that, but that was, in fact, the facts of the case, and it was a unanimous decision. It wasn't even a split decision, and you would have thought at least one of them would have seen it our way.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see what happens going forward. I mean, right now I could appeal to the Michigan State Supreme Court, but I have no plans, at least as we sit here tonight, to do that. But we'll see.
So it's an interesting time, gentlemen, right now, because legally things are happening which could either open up the ability to continue activism, or it could close it down, right? So it's a very important time, basically, a point in this. And the question is which way this is going to go. Is the law going to make exceptions for people that think things and ideas which basically overall the liberal New World Order disapproves of, and they will make exceptions to these kinds of people and put them in a different category? Because basically that's what comes down to, I would say. The treatment of us is different than the treatment of others. When Black Lives Matter can walk on the streets and talk about killing cops, right? And the same legal measures are not taken against them as it is on us. So it's an unfair situation, clearly. But if it's hashed out in the legal system, in the courts, it could also open up and basically is where it could be proven that it's like, okay, this activism, this is what it really is about. Because we're fighting against, and gentlemen, jump in if you think I get this wrong, but we're fighting against a media establishment that is creating a narrative and an idea of what it is that we're about, and we're letting them running this. And I believe that these judges and panels and all the, the courts and all of this is influenced by a massive media machine, which is creating this kind of image. So that is difficult to work against, guys. So is it the legal way? Is that going to be a solution for us, or is that going to be a downfall for us? What do you guys think?
I mean, we've seen in the instances of Richard winning court cases against some of these universities that we can quite often, we do quite often have the law on our side. But, I mean, those particular instances are such flagrant examples of denying someone their, right to free speech that, the universities and the judges just couldn't. I'm sure they wanted to deny Richard the ability to speak, but they just simply couldn't. But, I think we just have to keep in mind that they're going to throw the book at us every chance that they can. The situation with Chris Cantwell is a perfect example. He pepper sprayed someone in self-defense, and he's facing, it's something like 30 to 60 years. I forgot the exact number, but keep in mind, multiple people in this call were just, pepper sprayed, trying to get into the rally, trying to peacefully enter the park. And the people that did that were able to do so with impunity. They're not going to face any legal consequences. The cops stood by and watched it happen. The cops stood by and watched while Antifa hurled bottles of urine, excrement, acid at us, and, you know, those people aren't going to face 30 to 60 years. But Chris Cantwell, you know, tries to defend himself in a brawl, and he uses pepper spray, and you know, that's what he gets. So, I mean, to answer, you made a comment about us not doing activism anymore. I mean, if the system really does start cracking down legally, then we're not going to stop what we're doing. If anything, that might just warrant perhaps a change in the ways in which we are doing activism. But, you know, a lot of that is dependent on the results of this lawsuit, so we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, you mentioned something. I'm glad you brought up Richard's victory. That does show that you can win. A lot in life comes down to timing, and sometimes in the legal world it comes down to venue. Richard won in Alabama, and in Michigan I may have received Yankee justice. And I'm not going to say that this wasn't the honest interpretation of the law that these three judges in Michigan had, but it's hard for me and Kyle Bristow to see how they could have come to the conclusion that they did. But that's not to say it was politically motivated, but it could come down to venue and judges that you get in these different parts of the country where we're engaged in lawsuits. But Andrew Jackson once said, the courts follow closely upon elections, and maybe if we start winning elections, we can start winning in courts and prove whether or not that opinion was valid. But both seem equally distant at present.
If we want to flip that Jackson saying on its head, actually. The judiciary, after Donald Trump's victory, the judiciary has struck back, basically. They have attempted to assert its dominance and the dominance of what's called the deep state. I mean, that phrase is rather hackneyed at this point, since it's being used by Sean Hannity and Mike Cernovich or something. But it is a very real thing. It is effectively unelected bureaucrats who have interests that are never put up for a vote. And those people certainly are going after us, whether it's the Reagan building, whether it's perhaps this legal case, whether it's you know, the miscarriage of justice in James's case. We live in interesting times. I mean, this is not quite like being a dissident in the height of Stalinist Russia or anything like that, but it's a little bit like that, and we have to negotiate a situation in which people with a lot of power want to stifle our speech. We whose words have power, but people who, you know, in terms of money and influence and so on, have effectively no power in comparison with this behemoth we're challenging. Mm-hmm. So we are in a perilous state, and we should never forget that.
Yeah, but the recent case here that I was showing the tweet, I mean, they are literally conducting a manhunt for people putting up a piece of paper that says, it's okay to be white. I mean, if that doesn't encapsulate where we are at right now as a kind of a sample, I mean, I don't know what does. And it's remarkable because it's good. I mean, obviously, it's brilliant in terms of strategy because it forces, in fact, the enemies of white people to really play out their hand and show what it's truly is about. So it's very good. But it also shows other people that it's like, wow, if they're willing to go after people legally for doing something like this, I mean, where is this going to end? And it's a worrying trend. Absolutely. I mean, it's like, where do we go from here? And how is it going to be possible to even just advocate for white people existing in the future? You know, it's just, wow.
And we haven't even mentioned Silicon Valley's attacks, which have been arguably much, much worse.
Right, the censorship, the platforming and just taking people offline and you know, shadow banning and all those kinds of things. These are all very, very real. They have an effect in the real world, so to speak, and it takes people's influence and ability to communicate a message out of it. And we saw that even with Trump, right? They actually took down his Twitter account for, was it like 11 minutes? Might seem minute, but imagine, guys, what if someone tweeted from his account like, all right, we're going to, you know, we're striking North Korea right now with nukes. You know, I'm serious. I mean, this could be like, they have to have better control, basically, on what they're doing over there. And I think that it might lead to eventually that Twitter and Google and all these outlets need to have some kind of rules or stronger structure in place of who can use their service and how it's going to be used and this kind of stuff. Because if they can just boot people off however they want, they're going to limit information, basically, from being spread about any given subject. And obviously, that's wrong. So what are you guys' thoughts about that in terms of how to fight against that censorship and how to get them to
push back? I would actually say this, just to chime in. A lot of us in the alt-right were talking about what we call the great shutting. We were talking about this in very early 2016 when my podcast, a lot of Right Stuff podcasts were getting kicked off of iTunes. I'm sure Andrew Anglin was, facing, lots of problems with his website, to say the least. And we were just starting to get in this area. And I and some other people actually talked about this this prospect of perhaps there needs to be federal regulation of these social media companies and so on. That was a wild idea. That idea has now been voiced by Breitbart and Tucker Carlson and others. For some reason, they haven't given me any credit. I don't know why. Perhaps they've just forgotten. But I don't care, actually. I don't need the credit because, remember, when you influence people, you don't always get credit. And influence is what matters. And the fact is, we were out in front. We are the canary in the coal mine in terms of, facing these real censorship issues. Because again, like every conservative or libertarian would be like, oh, but they're private corporations. All right. We need to get beyond that. That is absolutely silly in the 21st century to talk like that. This is not like the local mechanic doesn't want to do business with me. Because I voted for Trump and he was a Hillary supporter and I could just go to the mechanic two blocks down. This is absolutely not like that. In the digital age, monopolies are created and effective monopolies are created very, very quickly. And getting kicked off Twitter is far, far worse, than a government, cracking down on a newspaper or something like this. So we have been out in front. We have been the canary in the coal mine in terms of being oppressed in these situations, and also in terms of talking about them and creatively coming up with solutions that ultimately the boring conservative movement, they're going to have to deal with themselves.
Yeah, we should issue the left to pick up that line of first they came for the Nazis, then they came for the white supremacists, and then they came for the white nationalists, and then there was no one left speaking for us. No, but I mean, I'm serious. I mean, there should be a reason, and I think
they're going to pick up on that.
Those intellectuals that are actually worth their salt, I mean, they will understand that it's like, yes, if you begin to cut away in this end of things, they will eventually do the same on the other ones, and we'll end up with a very small corridor of what is going to be accepted within the political, room, if you will, to talk about, to think, and who knows what else. And that's a very dangerous scenario, and anyone should realize that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Henrik. There's a very interesting piece that was done by the New York Times podcast, which I, as a New York Times reader, I listen to. I should just say that to horrify the New York Times.
They are now guilty. They're implied now. Guilt by association.
Yeah. They had a very good, they've done some very good work on the opioid crisis on their podcast, and they actually did some very good work on the ADL. And they talked to a lot of these older ADL lawyers who were, I think all of the ones who were interviewed were Jewish, not surprisingly. And they actually had no equivocation. There's no ambiguity. They said, absolutely, we stood for the rights of this, in this famous case, I'm forgetting it at the moment, of a neo-Nazi group actually marching in a Jewish town, which is, needless to say, highly offensive and probably entirely unnecessary. But actually, the ADL supported their right to have a march in this town. We've moved on in a way, and they interviewed some of the, millennial and maybe some Gen X people who are now staffing the ADL, and they started saying all these just, incoherent platitudes, we actually need to expand free speech by, fighting back against hate speech. So they all this kind of loop-de-loop thinking and bullshit, to put it, not to put too fine a point on it. And so I actually think things are changing. There are a lot of people who are awakening to our ideas and to our powerful arguments about, you know, deplatforming. At the same time, we're going to face a left that is different than the left that our fathers and grandfathers faced. Arguably, it's better in some ways. It's actually a lot, lot worse in a lot of ways. And their appeals to emotion and feels and all this kind of stuff in order to shut us down, this is going to happen a lot more frequently going forward. These kind of high liberal abstract arguments of free speech are giving way to "my feels were hurt" arguments, and those arguments are ultimately more powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're entering into a post-liberal age where I think both the American right and the American left are going away from liberalism. I mean, obviously, there's still going to be the boomer, kind of more left-wing liberal types, but the new left or whatever you want to call them, the types that are being churned out by universities, you know, they don't believe in freedom of speech. They don't believe in any of that. They're Bolsheviks. They're Marxists, and
they are.
You know, obviously, on the right, I've heard of other anti-liberal, illiberal trends being developed, certain movements on the right, and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see where things go in 50 years, but it's certainly not going to be liberalism.
Well, Tumblr Bolshevism.
I'd like to
national Bolshevism. Yes.
I'd like to work this in very quickly while it's rattling around in my head, and this may be cliche, and we've probably all heard it before, but the only rights a man has are those that he's willing to fight for. And men far greater than ourselves have suffered far worse. You think, talking about Charlottesville, I mean, certainly we were there as a stand for white identity, but the reason we were there in a nutshell was the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue. I mean, think of a man like Robert E. Lee, quite arguably the greatest American that there's ever been, a really almost stainless individual. He has suffered a lot more than we have. So certainly, again, I mean, in my case this week, a court decided that one doesn't even have to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan to be its leader, and this is what we're facing. But these horrible defamations that we have to endure really pales in comparison to the sacrifices of blood and bone that the greatest heroes of our race have offered and sacrificed. So the reason we're fighting now is because we don't want it to have to come to that, and it may come to that, and we hope it doesn't. But that's why we have to take a stand now while there's still at least a little bit of time left on the clock, and that's why we will continue to fight and sacrifice. I think all of us are probably in worse shapes for having engaged in this struggle than we would have been otherwise if we had used our talents to pursue the typical life of making money and having a soulless existence. But we're better than that. And on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, we can channel Martin Luther. And we'll continue to stand.
Yeah, they're coming for every statue. We've mentioned this many times, but I mean, in the images we're looking at, that's really it. I mean, they will tear everything down. They will rename everything. There will be no heritage or history left on the people that built, the United States of America. And so that is also, we got to remind people of what that fight is about. It's a stand against an attack on heritage and culture. So you're absolutely right, James. And if we don't stand in the way, there we're one of those clowns with the hats on. If we don't, stand in the way of that, there's like no end in sight, basically. But guys, let's, we're going to wrap up in a little bit here, but let's squeeze in whatever else we should talk about when it comes to the lawsuits. I want to make sure that you guys also get out information about what everyone out there watching can do to help. Where are the websites people can go to donate to the legal, funds and all that kind of stuff. But before we talk about those things, anything else that people should know about the legal cases or the consequences of it or anything like that? Just head into it, guys.
I think we've said enough, but actually, could someone who knows the exact details just repeat how what is the best way to donate money to the Legal Defense Fund?
Nathan,
why don't you reiterate those, Nathan?
Yeah, so the best thing you could do is either fill out a check to Identity Europa Defense Fund and send that to the P.O. Box of Foundation for the Marketplace of Ideas. Make sure you mark it to us, though, because otherwise, it will not be set aside specifically for Charlottesville. It will go to the general pool that FMI has for other things. So if you want to donate, that's the best way to do it. Unfortunately, we've been shut down. We've been no platform from a number of places like PayPal where it would have been easier. There are still other options. If you have Bitcoin, you can go to our website, click on the donate button. There's Bitcoin. There's also our PO box. If you want to donate to us and write a check to our PO box, you can do that as well. Same thing, Identity Europa Defense Fund. That way we know specifically what it's for. And you can also jump on our Patreon. Now, Patreon's a little bit more different. It's a monthly recurring payment thing, and they don't have an option to just donate one time. So if you go ahead and do it that way, you can't just sign up to donate, say, $100 and then cancel it and expect us to still get it. You kind of have to leave it there, I think, for like 30 days or a month or so. Till that goes through. So usually it's easier if you use Bitcoin or if you cut us a check, either if you send it directly to us, but it would be better if you sent it to Foundation for the Marketplace of Ideas, because that is a 501c3 and it is taxes exempt.
Very good. We have the website right there. We can add a link on later in the description, folks, for those of you that want to check that out. Okay, well, very interesting, guys. Bizarre and interesting times. And was there anyone? Let's finish off with this. Was there anyone that had any suspicion or like sense of that it would go in this direction? I guess I'm talking more generally about Charlottesville, and then of course everything has kind of, you know, come in the wake of that. But was there any one of you that felt like, you know, well, this could go bad, or this could not be a good idea, or anything like that? Was there any hunches?
I had 100% optimistic feelings with Charlottesville 1. I had 100% optimistic feelings about Charlottesville 3, and I was proven right. I had a lot of skepticism and trepidation about Charlottesville 2 for a number of different reasons, probably beginning with the organizer, to be frank. The fact is, it was what it was. I don't regret going. I'm glad we were there. And also, no one can really predict history. What you have to do is stay strong, plan, but also recognize that it's not, we can't predict what's going to happen. The real question is how we're going to respond to what happens, how we're going to respond to each new obstacle and each new challenge. I think a lot of us had a certain bad feeling about this when it came to Charlottesville 2. But I don't regret going. I don't regret being part of history. And I don't regret standing up for, first, the statue, secondly, our people, and thirdly, our rights as citizens to speak freely.
Yeah, and then for me, so I helped organize a lot of the Charlottesville 2 kind of speaking with the police, talking to the various security groups and things like that. And I did feel like there was a chance that some bad things could happen, but that ultimately that they would just want to get this out of here, and that if they thought that if they did a good job, or if there was no violence, that we wouldn't come back, is basically the way I thought that it was going to go down. That it was really in their best interest to basically get this over with. However, right when I got there that day, the very first kind of decisions and things like that that I saw going on by the police, the fact that they changed some of the routes coming in, and the ways that we were supposed to get, you know, equipment in, the sound system in, and also the way they were operating on Market Street and things like that, I immediately knew there was going to be an issue. I would say, though, is that part of the way we organize this thing is really, instead of, you know, going real detailed as far as like minute by minute planning, we had in place, you know, a strong kind of structure as far as like the different, you know, organizers and things like that, kind of being able to push information down the chain, and also making quick decisions. So I do think that we made good decisions on that day with the information we had at the time. And it is unfortunate ultimately that the police weren't kind of willing to do their part at all to make sure it was a successful day as far as safety goes. So I think that when it comes to moving forward, though, you know, Gainesville, I work with the police again on Gainesville, with a couple other guys, and I was very, very confident again with them, but I already had under my belt Charlottesville. And I really basically said to the police, you know, I no longer trust you guys. I no longer trust that you're going to have our safety, guaranteed, but I will respect you, and we will make sure that we come up with our contingency plans if this goes south and all this other stuff. And that's kind of how we're going to have to move forward now, I think, is that we're always going to have these plans on what to do if the local kind of police departments or our city or local governments or whatever do conspire to essentially shut down our civil rights.
What's your message to them? I mean, if they just listen to the mainstream media, they you know probably have reasons to worry because this is just some big murderous machine that's building up, and you know, what's the message to them?
Because the police that day, and Richard remembers this, you could tell they were either laughing, which is disturbing, or like you could tell they felt terrible about what they were doing, which I thought was very interesting. Like one of the guys, like.
You're talking about Charlottesville, too.
Charlottesville, too, yes. He felt terrible about what he was doing. And one guy I remember seeing, I thought he was going to start crying by pushing us. Anyway, and really, like, the understanding that we have with these police and kind of how this is going to move forward is going to be important to understand that these people can't, we can't just trust what they're going to say or trust what they're going to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, remember Florida. I certainly had some trepidation going into Florida. I expressed those concerns in some interviews. I was treated very well by the police. I was treated very well by the bureaucrats. That being said, remember, there were tons of people in that auditorium who were effectively preventing me and others from speaking. They were just screaming at the top of their lungs. I mean, again, I'm very proud of Eli, Cameron, Mike Enoch, myself. We all went up there and stood them down. That being said, you know, one could make one could easily make a case that those people screaming should have been escorted out of the auditorium, and that the police should have been better in terms of handing out individual tickets, which we had to take over. So I guess it's that kind of trust but verify, or act in good faith but nevertheless be skeptical. If not a bit cynical, I think that's how we have to act going forward. The way I acted, say, with the Reagan building for all these years, I don't know how many conferences I've held the Reagan building. I think it's five or so. James is at one. Nathan's been at one, et cetera. I just, you know, I went in there totally in good faith, and perhaps I was a bit naive. I can't be naive like that going forward. We're going to have to be savvy. We're going to have to be skeptical of dealing with these organizations and know that some of them might really be against us, as in Charlottesville, in which the Charlottesville police would have preferred mayhem to an orderly, peaceful rally.
And then real quick, just to answer your question, like, what is our message to these people? I said this a little bit in Gainesville, but really I think that what they're so afraid of is our ideas and our words. They had no intention of letting us speak in Charlottesville, too. And they're really terrified that our message is permeating throughout the entire country and really the white world, and it's terrifying them, I think, is really what this is showing. So my message to them is that, you know, fundamentally they agree with us, and if they knew anything about their own history, their own kind of, like, leftist civil rights movement mythos that they have, they would understand that the harder they push against us, that the more easily we're going to be able to maneuver back at them. It's sort of like judo or something like that, where we're really going to be able to kind of take the fight back to them with this. So I really think that these people, you know, if I was in their camp, I would be advising them to basically not be doing this, not be backing us into a corner, because in a lot of ways, like I said earlier, this is something that's actually helping us, you know, organize and basically move forward with a serious movement in ways that wasn't happening before this.
And speaking of that movement, we all need to be above reproach to the extent that that's possible. I understand that the media is always going to portray us as they will, and there's nothing we can do about that, but we need to give them as little ammo as possible. Now, we all share scars on this, but what's on our shoulders is a great burden and a great responsibility. I've been at this for 13 years on the radio and been around the block a few times, been consistently covered that whole time. So we're all there. And I think if other people were going to present themselves as leaders, they would have shown it by now. And other people will come. But we have to learn from our, not mistakes. There is no army that has ever run the table and won every skirmish. So not mistakes on our part necessarily, but we have to learn from setbacks and not be discouraged by those setbacks and come back and evolve and be smarter and be stronger going forward. And I think that there's enough talent in this movement that we can do that, and there's a lot of talented people on this video conference today, and I think the future is going to be bright, but it's not going to be easy.
Well, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it. Thank you guys for being here and give us an update on what's happening. And, of course, moving forward, we'll have some links to the donations that we talked about as well down in the description. We'll add it after the live feed, of course, in there. So check that out, guys. But, yeah, thank you, gentlemen. Really appreciate it. Have a good night, everyone. And we will see you guys later. Take care, okay?
Thank you, Henry. Thank you, guys.
All right, there we go, ladies and gentlemen. So we'll wrap up right there. Yeah, I just want to say thank you for watching Red Ice TV. Have a great night. We'll see you on the next one, of course. Until then, take good care and have a good night.